What's next for IT? In today's economy, technology touches every aspect of the day-to-day operations of business. There has never been more pressure on IT to deliver for our organizations. So what can we expect over the next decade? We need to think differently about how we approach our work to continue to thrive into the future. This requires all of us to be intentional in how we look at our role going forward. Smart IT is an approach to getting the important things done by transforming the way we think, work, and lead. And now, let's disrupt the status quo, simplify the complex, and reduce risk the Smart IT way. Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Smart IT Podcast. Today, I look forward to chatting with Kat. Hey, good morning, Kat.
Hey, good morning, William. Excited to be here.
Well, it was good to see you. We haven't caught up in a while and got a chance to see you at TEDx here a couple of weeks ago. So it was good catching up.
Yeah, likewise.
It looked like we had everybody who was in innovation hanging out there. So it was kind of good to see technology and all its uses and all the different human aspects of it. So I enjoyed myself. How about you?
Yeah, it was nice to see the silos broken. I feel like in technology, you kind of see the cyber people grouping together, the health tech people, but TEDx really broke all those barriers. And it was just good to see the whole community kind of come together as one.
It is nice because sometimes we get caught in the nuts and bolts of the bits, the bytes, the firewalls, the containers. So it's nice just to kind of see how it's actually being applied in real world situations.
Yeah, definitely.
Well, I think probably one of the things that came out of that and probably what we see in the news all the time is this emphasis on data. So I remember maybe 10 years ago, the whole thing was about big data. So obviously we evolved since then. We've got storage that's much cheaper. We don't even think about how much we're storing things. So images, data, real-time analytics on the back end. We just got a lot of it. And a lot of corporations are trying to mine this data to help their businesses. And that leaves IT and IT leaders and their teams to kind of figure out how to collect all this data, sift through it, make use of it on the real time, the front end. Got a lot of things on the middleware and then on the back end as well. And obviously that's powering a lot of things with AI as well. So it's a lot out there. But I think sometimes we get excited about the technology. I do myself. But I do like to kind of take a step back here and just remember why the business cares about any of this data at all, right? Either if it's driving the retail store on the front end or the hospitals for patient care, or you go to your e-commerce site, marketing teams are trying to glean this customer experience. It's all about helping make better decisions for the business to help drive revenue and control costs. So I know a lot of our friends out there, the CIOs, the CTOs, the data analysts are having a lot of good opportunities to figure out what to do with all this data. So what have you seen out there as people just kind of get their grasp around? How do we figure out what data is available? You know, how do we use it? How do we help make an impact for our businesses?
A big question. I think it can be broken down into a lot of ways. I would say the dependency on real time. You said real time data a couple of times, and I think that's critical, right? Data-driven insights are becoming an expectation in the market, right? Being able to pivot quickly, right? If it's marketing, making sure your dollars are well spent. It's knowing your customer base. So that data is now, it's a business asset just as much as anything else is. It's not just a piece of technology, but it's something that it's truly value, right? Like that is worth money. Mass amounts of money is the data that you have, whether it's customer data, processes and efficiencies, right? If you look at manufacturing, the data on how can we improve our processes, that can save mass amounts of money. So I think that it's a transition from following instinct to following like real-time data, pivoting quickly, and also knowing you can sell that data. I know that gets into a lot of other areas, but data is worth a lot of money. And the companies that are using it efficiently are the ones that are going to end up in a much better place in the market. And that's a huge competitive advantage is knowing, one, what data you have. How are you using it effectively? And then also seeing, is there a way that I can actually leverage this to bring in additional funds? Are there products that I can spin off based on this data that I have? So, I mean, it's endless, right? I mean, this even this tiny bit of the conversation could go on for hours, but there's so much changing just in the mindset of what is data? How do we use it? And just the value of it overall.
Yes, interesting. I even think of something simple as the phone number. Now, who would think in 2025 the phone number would be such a powerful identifier of experience? Now, when you check out at the store, they wanted you to put your phone number in there. And that quick little thing said, by the way, would you like to sign up for our royalty program, rewards program, or just so we can track things? And now you get all this other information about the customer experience just from that one identifier. I find it very interesting how the new ways they're using this to help improve experience. The other one is the driving through the car lot, and then they saying, hey, Mr. Reed. I'm like, how'd you guys know about that? I said, oh, you saw my license plates. That's the identifier in your system. And then you know my history and when I've been there. So even something as simple as license plates, serial number, name, phone number, it's interesting how they're kind of finding new ways in their business processes to improve this. Now, we mentioned scariness. So it's like, okay, is somebody watching over me all the time? Obviously, the big thing is when you go to search on Google, all of a sudden they email you something or maybe you see a certain ad. So I think a lot of times people are like, man, that's magical. But for IT, this is what they do every day, right? They find different ways to stitch all this together real time. So do you feel a little, I don't know, worried about the amount of data being collected? So businesses are using it. IT is enabling it. Do you have any thoughts on that?
I think it depends. It depends on how you look at it, right? So I'm on the younger end of the millennial scale, right? So I grew up, I just kind of know this is being collected, right? And I think, look at Netflix, for example. It knows what I like most of the time. Not perfect yet, but like it's that hyper personalization, right? When I'm looking on Target, it's like, oh, if you're looking at this coffee table, this bowl would go great with it. Right. So it's getting to know my taste and it's making my experience significantly better on a lot of these platforms in theory. And I think as long as there's one education and understanding of the security that comes with that and things are being built with security at the forefront and not as an afterthought, it's an amazing tool. Right. If I look at my ChatGPT, right, it knows me so well now. Because it's built up my persona. Now it's personalized to me. It knows my tone, my style, exactly how I write. And I use it heavily. And if you see me writing on LinkedIn, I sound the way that I do in real life, right? So it's that hyper-personalization because it's gathered so much data on me. Is it scary that in theory, if that was used, someone could post on my behalf and the style would match exactly? Yeah. But at the same time, it's as long as we as a society understand what we need to have from a security standpoint, right? Like, I know not to put PII data in. I know not to copy and paste my company's financials in. So there's obviously a security challenge with a lot of the data that's existing. But I don't think it's a scary thing. I just think it's something that we need to be aware of. And I think organizations that are scared don't know the right questions to ask to get it to a secure place so that it can be implemented. So no, I don't think it's scary that there's a lot of data on me. But I also have to understand that I have to have updated passwords. I need to use a password manager. As long as I'm taking security steps and I'm trusting the vendors that I work with, it's that shared liability that, yeah, it's a little scary, but it gives such a better experience because it's so personalized to me individually, and that makes my life a lot easier. So it's a balancing act. I guess there's no black and white answer, and there's a lot of people that will fully disagree with that answer, and that's okay. We're all on different levels and scales of how much trust we have, and I guess the ecosystem as a whole. But for me, I'm kind of sitting in the middle.
Yeah, and it points out a very good key criteria here. It's more upside than downside. There's a lot of capabilities we get. On the other side, if you say, I don't want to share any information, then the implication would be you as a consumer would have to pay for things to stay your own information. Like you have to buy your own email system, right? Because you don't want to do free Gmail because Google is getting your data. Well, if you start to add up the cost of all of these things of staying private, you can find that you're spending a lot of money and time and effort trying to be more secure when at the end of the day, you're giving your information out all the time anyway, right? Even if you go to the doctor's office and manually fill out paperwork, you're giving over very sensitive information. It's just in a different format. So I'm a little bit older than you. So I'm on the same camp as you. I love the opportunities and the benefits that I get from sharing some information. But your social security number is shared so often, but it's in benefit to not only the company, but you and society as a whole. So I'm good with the trade-offs as well.
And I think the most important thing to remember is your data's out there anyway. Maybe not all of it, but a good portion of your data is quite easily findable by anyone that has any basic hacking skills. Right. Like I'm not talking anyone sophisticated, right? Like you have so much data that's already out there. Own that, acknowledge it, make secure choices with that. But like it's already out there, right? Even if I'm the most secure person, I exist on the internet. And there's a way to find what you want about me. Now, I shouldn't, you know, if I go back to 2014 or something, and I'm probably should go delete those Facebook posts that are like, my favorite animal is this. My high school mascot is this, right? As long as you're not putting too much out there, you're relatively secure as long, again, as you have those secure passwords. But your information's already out. So there's, in my opinion, and again, I know people will disagree with that, but your data's already out there. Yeah. It's not worth the offset of security to go so far the other direction.
And it's amazing how many of the modern day advantages we have in society are based on information sharing. So if you don't share information in the background, right up front, you have to share some certain information. And then all the entities and companies or organizations you work with need to share information. And it makes for a more seamless process. So I appreciate the ability to push a button on my phone and then the piece of the show up in like 20 minutes. It's a cool advantage I love.
Yeah. It's all for the pizza. Do it for the pizza.
Yes. Now, for the consumer, they love that ease of use of that single push. But if they look behind the scenes, then we're starting to get into all the work that IT is doing to allow that to happen, right? So from the development of the code, the building and design of the infrastructure, and all that security, I think it's kind of nice to step back, appreciate what IT is doing for all these organizations, and then to take those considerations of data privacy and the governance around it, ability to opt out, opt in, keeping our data safe. So as IT leaders look around at the landscape, they got a lot on their plate, right? They're trying to architect new solutions that the business are asking for. Obviously, they're working on AI because every executive been pitched on all the benefits of AI. So I mean, your CIOs, CTOs, CISOs are quite busy these days. And then sometimes they look around and find out their teams that might not be big enough, they think to kind of absorb all of this and keep up. So keep the lights on, enable all these new features, and oh, by the way, keep the bad guys out. So let's start talking about IT leaders as they look at their team and thinking, oh man, I don't have enough talent. Maybe I need to go out and ask the business, hey, can I get a headcount increase? Can I get two more people? I need two more analysts and two more architects. And the business come back and say, oh, we can't fund that right now. So let's talk about IT leaders looking at their team and thinking, maybe I need more.
I love this topic. It's a very broad topic. I think there's a lot of ways to find solutions for talent shortages. One, everyone's facing them. Resources are tight and teams are having a harder time getting funding for a lot of things right now. So the couple of things that I'm looking at when I'm working with leaders is, I would say, using AI as a force multiplier. Not as a replacement, but a multiplier, leaning on the ecosystem, leaning on your partners to step up and fill in and take off, maybe not full roles, but tasks where possible. And then automation is another thing where applicable. It's not in every case. But then also really focusing on upskilling and investing in your team. There's always going to be skill gaps, but when you can invest the money into people, they tend to be much more loyal and stick around longer. And then you're creating the workforce for the future rather than trying to scramble and find unicorns and realize that I can't afford a unicorn right now. Go build your own unicorns. So, you know, back to the one of the first things that I talked about is AI, right? AI is like a intern that really wants to please you, but like you wouldn't stick them in front of your board, right? They're really good at starting stuff off, right? AI is coding at a really decent level right now. There's obviously a human in the loop. But if the time savings of that code is 30 to 50% of their time, that's a huge force multiplier. Now, I've seen that be most effective when the AI is actually built internally and they can read the code base. They can say, these are approved from our GitHub. These are things we'll auto approve. These are the things we don't want to pull from. When it's truly built in your environment, it's much more effective than just writing and then transferring to your environment and then validating and testing. So there's that. And again, that's not just with IT, but that works from your marketing team, right? Can they toss together a marketing slick in about 30 minutes versus 2 hours? Because AI knows the environment, knows the tonality and the style. Forget the other points that I made. I know one of them is upskilling internally. Upskilling is going to be less on the hard skills in the future. It's going to be on like, how do you work with AI effectively? How do you ask the right questions of it? How do you partner with it? And then the soft skills, things like leadership, upward influence. Like, how do I get what I need from the board? How do I sell this project to my leadership? A lot of those soft skills, like cross-collaboration within organizations, change management, those are going to be far more critical because AI can do a lot of the hard skills, the things that make us human, that make people want to work with us, or the soft skills. Looking within the ecosystem, right? If, let's say I'm fully on AWS, there's probably ways that I can leverage AWS to take some things off my plate, right? If I'm fully in-house with AWS, they want to be a good partner. That's going to get them more business long term. So talking to the people within your ecosystem, ask them, hey, where could you support? Do you guys have anything that I'm probably already paying for that I don't even know what's in my environment? Lean on your vendors and your partners and get them to support you where you can. You should be doing regular audits to say, who is in my environment that I know of, right? There's always going to be shadow IT, but who's in my environment? What am I actually paying for? And have them educate you, because there's so much that you're probably paying for that you have maybe duplicates that you don't even know you have, and that could solve your problem. So building those partner and ecosystem relationships is absolutely critical.
And that's a very important point, because I think sometimes some IT personnel kind of think of the vendor partner, just sell me something and leave, and then they're stuck by themselves trying to implement it. But it's very opportunistic, right? Because they're incentivized to really help you, even if they don't upsell you today or something, but you have to renew their tech every period, a certain period of time. So it's in their benefit to actually help you. So I like that point there. And then how you ask is very important as well, right? So if you're just saying, you're going to install this new thing for Azure, AWS, and then hand it off, the health checks are helpful. Do you have more guides, more examples? Hey, can I talk to another one of your references who's also had this particular problem? I think sometimes IT doesn't realize how much help is available in that ecosystem that you're talking about, especially if you got like 100 different vendors or partners from tech, and that's a lot of resources.
Yeah.
So, one of the things I know, some challenges, like some CIOs may feel frustrated. You know, they went in after that headcount didn't get it, and they may not know exactly all the talent they already have in-house, right, and to delegate. Now, if you're a very important taskmaster who likes to delegate everything or control everything, then it can be very cumbersome for the leadership team. Let's talk about the leadership empowering their employees to go out there and run that. So instead of me doing a big AI strategy on every element for my analysts and my engineers, my developers, hey, I'm going to empower you as my team to go out there and experiment. You go talk to the partners. You go try something out. Let's talk about the spreading and dispersing the responsibility and finding new opportunities.
So I've been I've been trying to wrap my head around this, right? Because AI is so new. But I think it comes from two things. Culture has to be set from the top. The culture of innovation, the culture of exploration and testing things out, that has to start with the top, right? When there's no stupid ideas, when there's no like negative consequences for trying something new, as long as it's within a safe environment. Innovation comes from the bottom, right? The people that are doing the work daily, they know the inefficiencies. They know the parts where they could brainstorm solutions. So when you mesh them together, that's when you really get a good environment for testing things out, for better collaboration. When the bottom line is coming up with all these ideas, and then they're validating, what's the ROI of this? Is this something that we could actually do? This is a serious pain point, but maybe that's not the right solution. And then when you create a culture where everyone's putting these ideas in the hat and you're really getting like a think tank, that's when the magic starts to happen, because leaders are supporting those ideas and they're supporting the testing of things, right? Within obviously a secure environment. But that's where I'm seeing a lot of the magic.
Yeah, almost like you'd have like a biweekly show and tell. Like one developer said, I coded this new feature faster. And they're like, oh, how'd you manage to do that? Well, let me show you. I used some tooling. I leveraged a partner who helped out. And maybe I leveraged another colleague in a different department. And people say, oh, wow, I never thought about doing it that way. Or somebody said, how did you knock that new presentation out that fast? Well, let me show you. And I think a lot of times we get in these silo environments where so many cool things are happening and it's not being shared. Either maybe it's the political situation internally. Well, that's the security team is different from the infrastructure team versus for the team that handles maybe big data. So I think there's a great opportunity across the board from a leadership standpoint, like you said, to actually build that culture where you're freeing up these minds. Because like you said, if you have somebody there like 3, 4, 5 years in and are constantly encouraging them to upskill, you're investing in them, you're encouraging them. It's much, that's better efficient use of time than going out and say, you know what? I need to go hire this unicorn, 20 years of experience and all this and drop them into your culture and have them disrupting and saying, hey, this is the new cool person. Look how smart they are. It's like, well, these other 10 people have been there for like 3, 4 years and they've been developing. You need to make sure you recognize them so they'll feel encouraged to speak out and say, I found something that doesn't work well. I think we use a different tool. Hey, check this out. I think really, like you talked about before, that force multiplier, it makes a huge difference. So I think IT leaders should be looking at this as I have a lot of different buckets to pull from. So not necessarily having to say, I got to have a new headcount, but I got this junior analyst. Hey, in a year and a half, I think you're going to become a senior analyst. Or the developer, I think maybe you learn one programming language today. Maybe I get you on the track to go learn a new programming language. So there's just so many different ways. And so I wonder if some CIOs are still stuck in that old mindset, though, that they're holding back their teams and scaling. Because sometimes they're looking around the corner like, oh, I'm going to be gone in 3 years. So I won't worry about it. So when you talk to people out there, what are you seeing?
I think the best leaders want to be replaceable. They should want to work themselves out of a job where they're lifting people up. They're succession planning from day one, right? I can hire a unicorn, but I can't pay you enough money to care, right? Like a junior person that is, let's say they don't even come from tech. Maybe they're sitting in a help desk environment and they're like, I really want to go into cybersecurity. They've done the work. They've taken the certifications. They've shown that they're invested. The hard thing is resources are so limited right now. People are like, no, I need to find someone who can hit the ground running today. I get that's a great Band-Aid situation, and sometimes it's needed, 100%. But the long term is taking that, you know, junior cybersecurity analyst, holding their hand, you know, treating them kind of like an AI where it's like, you go do your thing. We're going to validate and check heavily. But let's use you to grow. And then, yeah, plan out that succession planning, work with them. That is, no one will work harder than someone you take a leap of faith on, right? Because this is a lot of people who are trying to break into tech, this is their one shot, right? They want to make it. They want to prove themselves. You can't pay for that. right? Even with an incredible technologist, not everyone cares about your mission, your values, your goal, the innovation that you're trying to deliver. And I think in an exceptionally competitive environment right now, taking a risk on those more junior people, they will upskill at rates that we don't even have an understanding of, right? Like the younger generation, and it's not just the younger, I mean, people make midlife careers, but the younger generation is so used to adopting technology at a rate that the older generations haven't necessarily experienced as heavily. Like they grew up in tech, right? Like they just kind of instinctually know this. And the rate of adoption has been so much faster over their lifetime. So they are quick learners. That is a huge skill set of theirs. And then also taking people that aren't from your world, you know, breaking that hive mind. A kindergarten teacher, that is a killer project manager right now. Like if you can chase down children, you can chase down developers.
Yes.
You know, so finding those transferable skill sets and bringing them into your org is going to lead to so much more innovation. And it's also going to find you really great talent, but you also have to have a recruiting team that's smart enough to see transferable skills and personality and culture fit, not just checkbox, you were a developer for 4 years, or check, you've got your PMP. It needs to be a lot more than just checking boxes. There needs to be a much more human approach to how people are filling these silos. And when you have the right team, that succession planning is easy. When you have the team that cares and wants to grow with you, you shouldn't feel threatened that someone's coming to take your job. You should be honored that you brought someone up to a level where they can, because then you can go on to bigger, better things. You can go repeat that at a company that needs it, right? That, I see that as an honor, right? Like when leaders can do that, that's incredibly impressive, because that's not common. I don't see a ton of that.
I know. And then, and they have that ability to understand how things get done. So you can't actually see new opportunities unless you know how it's done. But you know intimately how infrastructure is built, how it maps up to the business services, how it powers business revenue, then you can see those different elements. And then when you care about your teammates and people around you, then you can start to match those skills. And like you said, oh man, they heard cats very well in this area, in this project. Maybe there's somebody who's in HR who maybe want to migrate to a GRC function, and they never even thought about it. But that's that IT, you know, collaborating with HR and constantly looking at their people as like colleagues, resources to internally use, find ways to challenge them to make sure they don't get bored. Because the worst thing is, you've been developing these people, they're rock stars. And then they're static because either you won't promote them or maybe you won't invest in some extra education or class. And the next you know, they got an offer from somebody else and left. And it's like, it's a hassle to hire new people, right? To get them onboarded, acclimated to your organization, to the culture. So I almost think that you should be able, one of your strategic goals for IT is to have high retention rates, make sure they're happy, make sure they can grow. And it's like, I don't want you going somewhere or even doing a startup and innovating for something you could have brought to us. And it's actually cheaper, right? To get people internally to innovate. So talk about that thing when they get that call like, oh man, this enterprise architect just left and he went to the competitors. How they got some kind of a gut check.
I think it's, hiring is exceptionally expensive. Losing knowledge is extremely expensive. Right. There's so much that, like you said, an enterprise architect, if he's been at the organization for 5 years, you're losing much more than a headcount. You're losing someone that truly knows your system. We're not at the point where you can just download what you know and upload that to the new hire. Right. Especially if you look at legacy. There's like, look at a mainframe. You're not getting them out of college anymore.
Yeah.
You've got a mainframe. The people that know that, you're on a timer. They want to retire. So that succession planning and being able to really bring people in, lift them up, and understanding that when people leave, you're losing more than headcount, right? It's extremely expensive to find new employees, whether you go with a recruiting agency, internal with talent acquisition, even if you go offshore.
Yeah.
There's so much that people don't think about it. There's loss of productivity. There's leaner teams, which are causing the people on your team that are doing really well to get frustrated because they have additional work on their plate. There's, you know, the transition and the onboarding costs when you do find the right person. The list goes on. The recruiting costs themselves. I mean, think about if you get a few C-levels on different rounds of interview, what's their hourly rate? Multiply that by 5-6 candidates, and then maybe they don't even find the right person then. So if you look at all the costs that go into it, hiring is expensive. Not having people is expensive. Losing people is loss on the information and data side, right? It's the information that you're losing about your own org. Hopefully you're losing them in good terms, right? Where there is some of that transfer of knowledge. But even then, it's a drop in the bucket.
And it's another opportunity, right? So if you notice this person there who developed COBOL and worked on the mainframe, and you're seeing it getting up in the age, you can tell they're like, they want to retire soon. Yeah. Maybe you can get authorized to have them as a contractor for another 9 months to help with knowledge transfer, as opposed to saying, well, this is it. You're off. You're gone. You don't want to rush them to the door. But even if they go out, you know, they can still help out. So maybe they would retire a little bit later if you changed maybe some of their role, took something off their plate. And now you're starting to innovate in how do you think about, let me retain this knowledge to keep this capability. At the end of the day, you know exactly how that maps up to all these business initiatives. You know, your CEOs keep asking about, we got to grow. We got to expand. We got to go overseas. We got to do AI. All of these have a lot of technology dependencies. So the CIO got to make sure they're communicating what skills they need, what capabilities, and they manage that portfolio, right? The AI agents, the intern, I got 20 vendors here. I got 30 integrators there. So that's a cool way to actually see, this is the capabilities I have to actually get it done. And I'll spare the business all the technical details. So even if they say no for something, and of course, we gotta give some special attention to our friends to CISO, right? So we still have a very short time period here. We would love to say the CISO been in the job for 5 years. But we're seeing a lot of two and a half years, and they're constantly scanning. And when they get hired, it's like, I think this organization might be good for me. I look like they're investing in security. But I know a lot of folks are getting into these CISO roles and finding out, oh my God, a lot of technical debt, a lot of politics. They're not getting the tooling. So let's talk a little bit specifically about CISOs today and ways they can help marry with the CIO and CTOs and other leadership people in IT.
I think the biggest trends that I'm seeing for CISOs would be two things: not wanting to sit under IT, but be equal to IT, and two, mass rates of burnout. So starting with just not wanting to sit under IT, fast development does not always equal security. So when it comes down to the business, what do they want to see? They want to see product launches. They want to get stuff out to make money. And the CISO is like, we need to develop with security in mind. We need to really integrate from the start. They want to see the whole supply chain. They want to understand what's coming into my environment. What is streaming data out? Then you look at OT, and that's a whole nother ballpark. But them sitting under IT is not always the most valuable thing for them. That's not the most secure way to approach things. So I see a lot of CISOs, the trend is that for them to not want to sit under IT and to want to partner with IT very closely. Because if you look at security, that dabbles in, it touches everything. It's the horizontal function across all pillars of an organization. Data and legal are in the same boat. So when they sit under IT, you're trying to fit a horizontal function into a vertical silo. It's not always the best fit. Now, when you come from small teams, it is what it is. Sometimes that's just how it works. But as you grow, separating those is extremely valuable. And I think a lot of CISOs are wanting that. They're liable now. And that's part of the reason they're burning out at such high rates, right? Ransomware is becoming huge. Data leaks. I mean, it's in the news. Every single day you open the news, you're going to see some type of cyber attack, you know, data leak, whatever. It's happening. And they're personally liable for making sure that they find out about it and disclose it. So they're getting hit 24/7. They have to be on the ball every single day, right? They're at the front lines and it's exhausting. And then they're also fighting for budget and being like, no, this is why I need more resources. My team is burning out. You're going to lose good engineers, right? Like, we're going to lose good people, and then we're going to be even farther in debt. There's also understanding that a lot of CISOs are brilliant in security. But I don't meet a lot of IT leaders that were like, I went to leadership boot camp. Yeah. I learned how to talk to the board, right? A lot of it's self-driven, which is amazing that they're taking it upon themselves to do that. But where's the support system, right? Like, the support system shouldn't be, overnight call tree, right? Like, that shouldn't be their support system. They shouldn't have the levels of, I guess, they should be responsible, but the liability is so heavy on their shoulders right now. And there's no one really coming in and supporting that group. I think, again, cyber has the highest rate of burnouts in technology, and CISOs have a pretty short lifespan at a company. I'd say 2 to 3 years is the average, whereas the rest of functions are generally a little bit higher. So those are the two main issues I'm seeing facing CISOs. But yeah, they're under a lot right now.
And it looks like they may be getting caught because they're getting hired and then they want to, present themselves well. You know, I got the technical skills. I got these business skills. I can do a team. I can help stop bad guys. And I think they may be framing it incorrectly, right? As opposed to, I'm going to need capabilities to help mitigate risk, right? So we're going to interface with your GRC team. We're going to have board level metrics to actually measure aggregate cyber risk across the organization. And I want to map that back to capabilities and gaps, which go across, as you mentioned, horizontally across the organization. So they're in this trap where they're like, oh my God, I don't have enough budget. Well, IT should own asset management, right? And it was funny. I was talking to somebody in security and they were talking about they had to buy an asset management system and it's from the security budget. I'm like, wow, that's interesting. The IT team didn't own that. Well, it's a gap that didn't cover. So that's one of those red flags is like, do you know all the assets you have in your system? And you're not going to do it in Excel, right? So I want to make sure you have this tooling in place. It's up and running and it's mature. And by the way, how does a board normally get informed about risk analysis? Have you started thinking like risk quantification? Oh, we never heard of that. Interesting. Okay. And then what do you guys think about patch management? Who owns that? Like if I tell the development team or production team, I got a couple of criticalities in the DMZ. How does that work? So I think on the interviewing process, you have to be very diligent before you take the job to understand how much investments do they currently have? Do the teams manage the pieces they should manage? Like I'm not a developer, right? So CISO is not a developer. So do they have tooling to help check the code? What is a SDLC? Whoa, another red flag. Like, what do you mean? You don't have a pipeline? More red flags to say, this is what the industry does. This is how we manage risk. There's a secure development process. There's a secure vulnerability management program. And here are some teams that can do it. I say you guys might not have some of the elements. Are you willing to invest and make sure everybody's accountable? Unless you do that, I think they're going to keep getting stuck in these roles where it's like, well, they take care of all the patching. How can you even patch it? I don't touch this system. That's something a business unit owns. And you guys don't support that in your governance structure. So I think it really got to be careful for the CISOs that they structure and frame responsibility. Otherwise, they may get stuck in this loop of being burnt out.
I think the interview process has become messy on both sides. Yeah. No company's going to be airing their dirty laundry, right? When you're interviewing for a company, especially in a position like CISO where you have high liability, you need to ask very pointed questions to get, you're not asking, tell me about the culture. No, you're asking about those things like how stable, like where is your, threat intel program at, if you have one, walk me through what your GRC team is doing. Like, what have they been up to for the last year? Whatever those questions are, ask what you need to know so you truly know who you're working with. And I don't believe in a bunch of interviews, but I think when you hit the C level, you need to meet with legal. You need to meet with data. You need to know your peripheral. Because again, when you run horizontally, you need to understand the pillars, and then you need to know your teammates that are also working horizontally with you. Companies, they need people. They know their back of the house is a hot mess, but they need to hire someone to come in and fix it so they're not airing all their dirty laundry out. And a lot of the time, it's not the technology that's the problem. CISOs and CIOs can go in and they can fix a lot of stuff. They're very good at what they do. They're walking into other leadership that doesn't want to change. They're walking into bad processes, highly political environments. They're walking into things that are preventing the progress that needs to be made. And that's why they're struggling. They're fighting for something that people don't want.
Yes.
Right? Hiring a CISO is not a checkbox. It's not like, oh, we have a CISO who's advising us on stuff. It needs to actually be, we're bringing them in so that they can truly make an impact. And the team has to be bought in. Without that buy-in, the CISO is going to burn out. They're going to get frustrated because nothing they want to do can be accomplished without that partnership in the organization. Again, other C-suite falls into that same category. But I think with the CISO, it's even more critical. It all comes down to people and processes. And with the right culture in place, the technology is easy. Technology can be dealt with. People are the challenging part every single time. It's that change management. Like, you brought me on to make changes. Then you're like, oh, but that's not how we do things. That's why you're in a problem pick. Like, yes. That's why you're struggling right now. You know, so yeah. Making sure when CISOs are interviewing, you're asking, you're really uncovering, like, how willing are you to change? I want to meet with all the stakeholders that are going to be involved in with me actually executing what needs to be done. And then if you can really buy in with the people, you're going to be fine. But that's usually where I see struggles and why CISOs keep burning out.
That leads into an interesting point, too, for people who are looking for new jobs, their interview strategy, right, the research they're doing beforehand. How do you structure those questions where it's not like very pointed? So you can pull something out without asking a very pointed question, like, you care about cyber, or do you really care about paying your developers, or do you take care of your people? Let's talk about the strategy when you structure it. So you put a lot of education, a lot of studying, you got these great skills, you're looking at that next gig, and you're like, I really like this company from the outside, but I want to prepare to make sure, like you say, I want to talk to the right people during the interview process, and I want to feel comfortable. So let's talk about it from both sides, right? What companies can do better to make this process better, to make sure they're ferreting out and getting the right person, good cultural fit, right skill sets, business skills. And on the other side, as IT professionals, like, I want to make sure I'm not getting trapped here where they're answering the way they think I want them to hear it. Like, oh, yeah, we care about this, and you can take time off when you want, and if you really, really need something, we'll help out, and the CEO would jump in. Like, how do I make sure I protect myself before I make this huge investment that's going to take me over a year to really get acclimated?
So I would start with something that both sides should be doing. You know, I'm a big proponent of networking and understanding the ecosystem. When the company is reaching out to the ecosystem and the environment, the industry, and saying, who do you know that's a good fit? And the individual should be doing that too. Let's say I'm applying at Visa, right? I want to look through my network and talk to people that actually work there and be like, tell me about your experience. Like, truly and honestly and as openly as you can, what am I getting into? What do you like about your job? What do you not like about your job? I ask pointed questions. I'm not scared about asking pointed questions. And I think that you need to be clear because that's your livelihood, right? Yeah. And as a CISO, that's your liability, right? So that's critical. Ask what you need to ask. From the company side, the same thing. Reach out to your partners and your network and say, who do you like working with? Who is really good at what they do? Who fits our culture? From the company side, you need to know that. You don't need to know what you want to be. You need a realistic view of what are we at? What are we as a company? What is our culture? What are our values? What are our weak points and our gaps this person could fill? A lot of companies don't take the time to do that. A lot of them reuse job descriptions. not to be blunt, but it's what happens. And then on the candidate side, do your research from every point of view you can. I would trust my network heavily, but I also want to reach out to who has been with this company in the past in a similar leadership capacity. Why did they leave? What has the market been doing, right? If I'm in a going to work again, Visa Financial, what's the financial market looking like? What are the threats that that industry is up against? I need to understand what I'm walking into. And honestly, am I prepared for that? Do I know my own gaps, my own skills that I need to work on? Also knowing yourself, like what kind of personality am I? Like, you could have the most brilliant team in the world, but if they don't mesh, it's not going to be effective collaboration. So it's not a, oh, you're not the right fit for this job because of anything, except maybe you're a little more boisterous and you could scare some of the developers that just aren't that way. And a lot of it is just personality fit. But things you need to look at, if you're looking at a smaller company, understand their financial landscape. If you're looking at a bigger company, are they going through mergers or acquisitions? Look at all of these. You need to look at more than just the job description. 90% of the time, the job description is inaccurate. Maybe even more than 90. So really understanding who am I? Where are my skill sets? Like, is this industry something that I'm passionate about? Is this the type of environment from like an enterprise organization that I want to work in? Maybe I don't want to work enterprise. Like knowing that about yourself as the candidate and then as the company, truly understanding who are you as a company, what, making sure that if you know who you are, you can paint that picture to the right candidate, because misleading the candidate is going to be costly and not effective. It's just not going to work out.
So the bottom for the businesses, don't stop wasting so much money there. Stop wasting time. And one of those things we talk about, you mentioned the job description. I don't know why we still have not fixed this yet, right? The long list of things that most people can have. And then the hiring manager is like, well, I didn't build that description. Well, I gave some notes to the HR, maybe they went to a recruiting firm. And this weird description, like, what the heck is this? The person who needs this new teammate didn't develop it, and it went through your system on the back end. That's just another opportunity for the business itself to really fix that, right? Because you want to control costs, right? Keep expenses down and innovate. You want your talent in-house developing. You want to bring on new talent as fast as possible. And you don't want to waste anybody's time. So I think there is opportunity from a corporate standpoint to improve that entire process. And like, stop bringing people through the ringer for 7-8 interviews, 8 months, and then ghosting them. It's like, I expect, you know what, the mantra should be, in the age of AI, you're going to stop ghosting people. Because I was like, oh my God, it's too many applicants. We can't go through everything. Like, well, let's see if you can use technology and better processes to make the whole recruiting process more humane. So I think a lot of career seeking IT professional would definitely appreciate that.
There's so much we can talk about when it comes to the job process. When you're looking right now, there's so many topics we can go into, but I think applicant tracking systems, ATSs, they're not that smart. They haven't evolved very well. I'm going to be completely blunt and honest about it. There, a lot of the time, your resume is not even being seen. It's getting weeded out before it gets to a person. And then if you look at the average recruiter, they're on the younger scale and they're not tech savvy. They're general. They don't understand Azure, AWS, GCP. They don't understand what is similar and different between those two, right? And then you ask an AI to do something similar, and it's like, oh, you don't have AWS. I'm like, yeah, but you don't know what EC2 is. You don't know what all these other things are because it's not AWS. If it's not written exactly that way, that person won't flag, right, for the skill sets. And I think we need to train these tools to be better. And we also need to make sure that we're not relying on those tools thinking they're good at their jobs. Because frankly, they're not. We want it to get there. I would love that. But they're not there. And your resume is the history. That's it. It has nothing to do with who you are as a person, as a leader, how you approach problems. Your resume is great for being like, oh yeah, we're checking the box on these things, that person's worth talking to. But taking it a step further and integrating things like portfolios, look at someone's socials. Like, I know that sounds kind of silly, but your LinkedIn is your social life professionally, right? Like, how does this person speak? How do they interact with others? Just those most fundamental things. You can see someone, what I like to call out in the wild,
yeah.
Right? Like, how are they presenting themselves? How do they collaborate? How do they speak to others? What kind of content do they engage with? Are they engaging with hyper-political things that maybe don't align with your company's values? Are they, you know, going on rants on certain posts, right? Being able to check through all of that gives you a much better rounded view of who that person is. But until the systems get better and they stop giving you the top 10,
yeah,
which may or may not be a good fit at all, we're going to keep running into this problem where we're not getting to the best candidates because they're not even being looked at by a person. We're getting the top 10. Recruiters, like everybody else, want to be efficient. So they start there. And if those 10 people don't hit the mark, then they'll start looking for others. But in general, it usually stops at the top 10.
Well, it sounds like we got a lot of opportunity on both sides here to improve this process because it makes financial, there's a financial imperative to get it right. It's a human imperative to get it right. So I think with smarter people, smarter technologies, better use of finding better, good talent with a good fit faster is in everybody's best interest. Is there anything we haven't covered so far that you want to mention to my audience?
I don't think so. I think we covered a lot. But I know our conversation kind of went all over the board, but I think it all goes together, right? Just succession planning is critical. Investing in your people is critical. You know, adopt technology safely but quickly, right? And bring the right people to the table when you're making those decisions. Yeah. I don't know. We covered a ton.
I think we started with the pizza, right? The key thing is, let's get all this technology right with the right people so I can get my pizza with a push of a button.
It all comes down to pizza.
That's the key. The day. And to make sure you get the pineapple with the Canadian bacon on it properly.
Okay. I'm glad there's another Hawaiian pizza lover here because yeah. I feel you with that.
Yes. IT, this is your main imperative in 2025. Stop worrying about AI. Start thinking about pineapple and Canadian bacon on the pizza delivered under 15 minutes. This has been a fantastic conversation, Kat. I think it's going to be very insightful for my audience, especially for those out there in the professional field looking for their next big thing and making sure they find the right fit and right coaches. So this has been fantastic.
Wonderful to just speak with you again, William. We always have great conversations. And yeah, I hope this was valuable to anybody.
All right. With that, that's been another episode of the Smart IT Podcast. Until next time, take care. Thanks for joining another episode of the Smart IT Podcast, where we explore what's next for IT and disrupt the status quo, simplify the complex, and reduce risk together. If you like what you hear, please like, subscribe, and leave your comments. And for more Smart IT wisdom, check out my website at williamreed.info.